when and where he lived. We need, of course, contemporary letters, files, documents, and we are fortunate that we are actually able to have these. Unlike, for instance, if we contrast Rashi. In case of Rashi, we do not have a single line of Rashi's own handwriting. We do not have one word written by Rashi in Rashi's own hand. The Rambam, on the other hand, we have entire volumes of the Mishneh Torah. I've been to Oxford and held a chelik of Mishneh Torah written by the Rambam. So that there is an enormous difference in how much we can know about the two. Beyond that, the Rambam lived in Egypt for over 30 years, and in the Evan Ezra Shul there, there was a Geniza, Seamus, off the Ezra's Noshin there, and that Geniza, given the temperate climate there, held, so that when they discovered it in the 19th century, there were thousands and thousands of letters and documents and partial Svarim that were there, and many of them were extremely legible and shed light onto general life in the in Cairo, Fustat, and in Egypt in general, in the times and life of the Rambam. They're also in their letters written in the handwriting of the Rambam. The Rambam was born in 1135 in Spain, in Cordoba, Spain, a Spain that would be unrecognizable to us for a number of reasons. Firstly, because perhaps a fifth of the population was Jewish. Secondly, Spain was Muslim, not Christian, and they were advanced culturally, scientifically. They were the cultured people of the times. The Christians were backwards. They were wealthy, and the Jews were very much part of Muslim Spanish society. They were ambassadors, they were physicians, they were poets. They had trade routes to China, to India. The Jews were of a completely different stature than they ever had in the Christian world in the Middle Ages. They were given relatively a large amount of freedom. And this was part of the golden age of Spanish Jewry. It was coming to a close. Long before they were expelled, it was coming to a close. But nevertheless, the time that the Rambam was born, the Jews had a relatively good life in Spain. The Rambam himself was a descendant of a long and distinguished line of Rabbonim and Dayanim, and he learnt most of his Torah, Kanireh, from his father, who also taught him maths and astronomy. And because they were far from Muslim headquarters in the Middle East, so firstly, it wasn't as closely ruled by the caliph or sultan, or whatever the title was, but rather by smaller sultanates, fiefdoms that existed in Spain and in North Africa. It was further away from headquarters. And also it meant that the Muslims were less frum. The ideal situation for the goyim, for the yidden in Golus, is frier goyim and frumer yidden. When you have the opposite, it's ochem vey. But at the time, that was the setup. The goyim were into having a good life, and they weren't too bothered by their religion, and the yidden were able to be as they wished. The life under these Umayyads, there were, of course, different sections, different types of tribes amongst the Muslims, was relatively benevolent. All of this changed 7 years into the Rambam's life in 1142, when the Almohads, the other type of Arabs, invaded Spain, And in the beginning, it was just onerous in terms of taxation, in terms of certain restrictions, how high they could build shuls, that the mosques had to be higher. Initially, it was just restrictions to their lifestyle, but eventually in 1148, 6 years later, they were given one of three choices, which we see classically, unfortunately, in many places in the Middle Ages, and that is conversion, exile, or death. Those are the three choices. And although it is easy in hindsight to quote what is the relevant halachic solution to the problem, it is not easy for people to go into Golus and leave perhaps elderly parents behind, because there's no way they can travel. Bearing in mind that travel at the time was a total hazard, besides the fact that there were no roads, there was no type of law, so that you were open prey to anybody. And therefore, it was just an impossibility for certain people to travel. If you flee, you leave behind anybody that you're supposed to be taking care of. And similarly, if you have to take young children on the road, it's not an easy thing to do. So that, although the solution, perhaps, in theory, is easy, in practice it was far from easy. The Rambam, though, and his father took to the roads, and for 7 years they wandered around Spain. They were in the Sierra Morena mountains, and even during this time, the Rambam was not only learning, but he was in fact writing his first Sefer, which came before the Perush Mishnayos on Ibur HaChodesh, particularly complex area of halacha and of maths and of astronomy. And this is what he was able to do while they were literally refugees going, never mind from town to town, but from mountain to mountain. This is when the Rambam was creating his first area of Torah. Eventually, though, life became so difficult that in 1159, when the Rambam was now 24 years old, they moved to Morocco. Morocco, when he came, was still relatively non-religious from a Muslim perspective. But fortunately, he would be followed by this zealotry, and shortly after he got there, they imposed the same conditions on the Jews in Morocco. And there was a misguided letter that was produced by one of the Rabbonim in Morocco, which told people that conversion to Islam is Yehorek Valiavar, that it is the equivalent of Christianity, and therefore told people to submit Al Kiddush Hashem, and they should die Al Kiddush Hashem. The Rambam wrote his Igeres Nechama. He wrote a letter which he had to write anonymously, because what he was writing was that they should fool the Muslims. He said Islam is not kfira in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They also only believe in one God, and therefore it's monotheistic. It does not have the same rules as Christianity. And therefore, what a person should do is externally convert to Islam in order to save their life. Of course, this cannot be a permanent solution, and as soon as they are able to, they have to leave the country. They have to get out of there, but this way it will give them time to arrange passage, it will give them time to take some money with them. It's not a case where, you know, you just wire your bank in wherever else it is and you pick up the money when you get there. In this case, you took whatever you could take with you, and you had to survive on that. And people, when there were expulsions from England, when there were expulsions from Spain, people literally starved to death, because they couldn't take anything with them which was long-term. Therefore, the Rambam said, in order to save your life, this really was a case of pikuach nefesh, they would be allowed to outwardly convert to Islam, and as soon as the first opportunity presented itself, they would have to leave the country, and they could move to other Muslim countries, because different countries, the communication was such that it was easy to assume a Jewish identity, to reassume a Jewish identity in other countries, which was the biggest problem that the Jews had under the Christians. The Maranos were not Yidden. They were Jews who had officially converted to Christianity. Those are the ones that the church was hunting down. Long before the expulsion, 100 years before the expulsion, that the church came to town not to hunt Yidden, but to hunt new Christians, as they were called. But the Muslims didn't have the same fanaticism, and therefore you could leave the country and move somewhere else. Now, we have to understand that when he is writing the Igeres Nechamah, this is an act of tremendous Mesiras Nefesh. Because if they find out that he has written this letter, what he is telling people to do is literally to make fun of the Muslim religion. You'll accept it externally. You have absolutely no intention of following it. You do not believe in it at all. And the whole thing is Misafa Lachutz. But there's nothing there. And eventually, they traced back to the Rambam, or they were about to trace back to the Rambam, that he was the author of the letter, and he fled. A number of years later, in 1165, six years after he got to Morocco. He was now 30 years old, and once again, he had to pick up and leave. On the 4th of Iyar, he left on the ship bound to Israel, and he got there on the 3rd of Sivan. It took nearly a month to get from Morocco to Eretz Yisrael by boat. And he writes that from now on he will make a Sudas Seidor on this day when he arrives there, because of all the Nisim that happened to him at sea, that he didn't die. It was a perilous journey, even through the Mediterranean, Southern Ocean, but nevertheless, it was a very difficult journey. When he arrives in Eretz Yisrael, there is no real Jewish life there. They have gone through, by then, two sets of crusades, and basically it was surprising that there was still a blade of grass around, because the Christians and the Muslims had fought over this ground. And even though the Christians hadn't managed to hold on to Yerushalayim for long, they'd been only for a few days, they'd held on to it long enough to kill all the Yidden in Yerushalayim. And therefore there was not even a minion of Yidden in Yerushalayim when the Rambam came. And he was there, he stayed there for a very few days. He went to Hebron, same story there. They were posh, there was no possibility of living life there. His father was by now elderly. And therefore he left, he couldn't sustain a family there, and he moved to Egypt. Egypt was a country which, at the time of Churban Bayis Sheni, had 1 million Yidden living there. A place where Yidden lived all the way through Bayis Sheni. We know the tragedy of Ches Teves was the fact that they translated the Torah into Greek. When we mean Greek, we mean the Ptolemaic Greeks, the Egyptian Greeks. And there had been a yishuv there by the time the Rambam came for nearly 1,500 years. But the numbers had reduced dramatically. There had been tremendous Christian anti-Semitism when they controlled places like Alexandria. There were tremendous shechitas in the 4th century, 5th century, and there were now 30,000 Yidden living in Egypt. And interestingly enough, the Rambam became, shortly after he arrived there, he became the chief rabbi of Egypt, a position that he would hold for over 30 years, till the end of his life. And he confronted a type of Yiddishkeit that he hadn't seen before, not in Spain and not in Morocco. And that was the Karoim, the Karaites. In Cairo alone, two-thirds of the Yidden there were Karoim. They did not believe in Torah Shebal Peh. And as somebody who, of course, defended Torah Shebal Peh, the author of the Yud Gimel Ikarim, clearly the question was, what type of relationship do you have with the Karoim? In his Trivus, he was asked the question, Me'inyan hakroim, Ech yisnagu harabonim imohem, how should rabbonim deal with the crime in the Middle East? It's not only Egypt. V'milas b'neim, can you give a bris to their sons? U'b'shayla shlemam v'leleches b'otem, and about their wine, what should you do? How do you deal with these people? And the reason this tshuva is so important is because the Rambam is one of those people in our history who other branches, quote-unquote, of Judaism are prepared to claim as their own. You know, the Reform movements and secular Jews, they're not embarrassed about the Rambam. I don't know, maybe they didn't have long pears. So, you know, they don't mind claiming the Rambam as one of their own. He was a philosopher, he did all the right things. He was a doctor, and therefore they don't mind talking about the Rambam as one of us. So, you know, you move from the Maccabees, right, to the Rambam, and then you move basically to 1948. In between, there's nobody of note that they're the Vilna Gaon, maybe, right? But basically, there's nobody there who they're interested in. The Rambam is one of them. And he was the middle-of-the-road person, you know, Derech HaEmtzai. Hagam, he wrote the Yud Gimel HaKorin. Right, which talks about that somebody who does not, he writes in the Perush Mishnayos, more than in Mishnah Torah, that somebody who does not believe in these Yud Gimel HaKorin, mitzvah l'sonei. Right, but, you know, that they gloss over. So it's important to know how he deals with this, because it's applicable, relevant to today. There's no reason it should be any different. So he says as follows, Ke'ela akrom ha'shef nimpoi. Those people, those Kroim who live here, in Damascus, in Damascus, or B'Shamakrim, it's Eretz Yisrael, Ru'im heim l'chalkom mechalkei hakovod u'liskarev etzlom. You can treat them with covered, you can be close to them, b'masei yesher u'lisnai gimon b'midas ha'nova v'derach ha'emes v'asholei. As long as you can be on perfectly cordial terms with them, more than that. Kolzman, as long as they behave that way as well, as long as they treat the Rabbonim and the deus of what it was called at the time, Rabbinic Judaism, correctly, as long as they behave themselves, as long as their views are not to make fun of the Chachomim, are not to make fun of Shas and of the early Rishonim, then fine. And then he says it's a mitzvah, he carries on, and a tshuva to carry out Bris Milah on Shabbos, and to be Menachem Ovel, and to be Mevakeh Cholah. But, he then says, if their attitude is such, is that they're being malig al dibre chachomim, both the chachomim of the Doer and the previous chachomim, then you're not allowed to give them a bris milah on Shabbos. And so you have an insight into the Rambam, besides for the fact that he wrote what one might call theoretical Torah in the Mishnah Torah and Perush Mishnayos. He had to deal on an ongoing basis with a real issue of Torah being disparaged or just being not observed, and he was the chief rabbi. So, you know, how do you go forward? He dealt with it. And by the time he died, the amount of crime in definitely where he was had severely diminished. He also, there's another truva a little bit earlier about mikveh. Nidda was the way they kept Hilchas Nidda at the time was very different, was wrong, and he instituted, he calls it a takona that he has made for the way to go forward in that area as well. Now, the society that he came into in Cairo was, in a way, very usual for the Yidden at the time, and also in some ways quite extraordinary. There were about 3,300 Jews in Cairo. Once again, we have this because we have the census from the documents that were left over in the Geniza. Of the 3,300 Yidden living there, 500 of them were breadwinners. which meant that there was a lot of poverty. If only one in six adults is earning money, that means there's a lot of poverty around. And one of the reasons, even though it was relatively okay for Yidden living there, and the pogroms and the expulsions, but there was the poll tax, which was aimed specifically against non-Muslims, and therefore that impoverished many Jews. Interestingly, society was not quite what one might expect in a Jewish-Muslim environment. Women were involved in business, especially the wives of people who traded abroad, who were away from home for many weeks and many months. So the women often ran their husbands' affairs. And there was even a woman who was nicknamed the broker, and she had a partnership. She got expelled from shul at some stage, and she is on the list of people who donated stocker, and she died rich. So that's the classic definition of what we would have expected 12th century, especially Jewish Muslim society to look like, not quite and the picture that we have in mind, and that's because Egypt was more cosmopolitan than the the society under other Arab rulers. Now, at shortly after he came to Egypt, he published his Perush HaMishnayos. Published, I mean, there was no printing. He wrote his Perush HaMishnayos. He wrote it in Arabic. And, as I mentioned, it also contained in it the Yud Gimel Ikarim, so he was not only creating a perush in the sense that he was explaining the Mishnah, he was also putting down Yesodos of Emunah, which you actually, other than probably Reb Sadyugon, you don't really find formulated anywhere. So not only is he creating a perush, he is also creating a hashkofa, if you want, a philosophy of what Maminim have to follow. Of course, there was debate whether it should be 13 or 3. Rabbi Svalbo, 200 years later, would say that really the 13 are 3 and the others are Anofin Peseda. But those were the Ikorim of Yiddishkeit. And while he was there, a similar situation to the one that had developed in Morocco, happened in Yemen. There was a Jew there who set himself up as Mashiach. In fact, the Rambam writes in a letter to a Rav in Marseille, he writes that the Sultan eventually caught this false Messiah. And he said to this Jew, he said, "So prove to me your Mashiach." So he said, "I'll prove it to you. You can cut off my head, and I will live." So they cut off his head. He apparently didn't live. And then the Rambam writes, and there are those that still believe he's Mashiach. Right? So he had a very real problem in his hand. The Jews in Yemen wrote him, what should they do? And at the time, there were also other issues in Yemen, whereby the Sultan eventually got fed up, and he said he gave them also this choice of conversion or death. Once again, here the famous Igeres Tamon, which builds on the Igeres Nahoma, where he quotes extensively from the Gemara of Meir eating pig in order, because it's not Yehoret Val Yavar, not all mitzvahs are Yehoret Val Yavar. And once again, B'mesiras Nefesh, anonymously, he's a figure of note in the Muslim world. They know who he is. And yet, he was Mesir Nefesh to write to the Yidden in Yemen, to tell them how they should live their lives, that they shouldn't leave town. And of course, as we know, the Yidden in Yemen continued there, come up to this very, I mean, there's very, very little left, but up until a few years ago, there was a continued Jewish presence still there. And eventually, in 1174, they nullified the decree, and the Yidden in Yemen adopted the Rambam as their Meira Halacha. He was the one whose Halacha they followed, and when they, in the Kaddish, they added in B'chayeichon v'yomeichon v'chayeh Rabbeinu Moshe ben Maimon. the Mashiach should come in his lifetime as Hakara to him. Shortly after that, a tragedy occurred to the Rambam, which had its effect not only on his personal life, but on his whole Hanhaga. And that is that his brother David died. His brother David was lost at sea, he was a trader, and his brother had been supporting him. And the tragedy affected him to such an extent that for nearly an entire year he took to bed. The sorrow was such that he couldn't get over it. And at the end of it, he needed to support now not only his own family, but the almona and the children of his brother. And that's why he became a doctor. Because he had no other choice. He was forced into this situation. And having done so, he became one of the most famous physicians of his time. He was approached by either Richard Lionheart or the Christian King of Jerusalem to become his physician. In other words, he was known in the Christian world, but he stayed with Saladin because it was a far better option for the Jews to be under Muslim rule than under Christian rule. But we must not mistake why the Rambam became a doctor. He became a doctor because he was basically forced into it. In 1180, he produced the Mishneh Torah. Mishneh Torah is known not only for its siddur, for the fact that it brought halacha together. It's difficult for us to understand the achievement of being mesada all of halacha, not on P, the Rif and the Rosh, who wrote on the Shas. Of course, they need to be enormous Bekir B'Shas, but nevertheless, what the Rambam did is he extracts all of Halacha from all of Shas and is Masadar it in blocks, so to speak. We cannot underestimate the achievement of the Rambam, a clarity of Siddur and a clarity of language. And as a result of producing this, he is now elevated to one of the greatest of the Rishonim, the League of Rashi and the Rambam. The one chisaron in the Mishneh Torah is that there are no Maror Makomos. And because of that, it's difficult to argue with the Rambam because you're not sure where the Rambam got this halacha from. Especially if we bear in mind that in the times of the Rambam, he had the Yerushalmi on Kodshim, which we don't have. In the interim between now and then, it was burnt, it was destroyed, and we no longer have it, but he did have it. So sometimes it could be that that's where he found the halacha. And therefore, it's not a diuk in an existing shas that we have, but it posha in areas that we don't have. It's very difficult to argue with it, because you don't know where it was from. Nevertheless, of course, those who debate with the Rambam. In fact, even the Shulchan Aruch himself, who of course adopts the Rambam as one of his main three, the Rosh, the Rif, and the Rambam, for paskening halacha, even so, at times, paskens against him. Now, when he produced the Mishneh Torah, this he produced in Lashon Kodesh. Because unlike the Perush Mishnayos, which was there in order to help people learn, and therefore it was written in Arabic, the Mishneh Torah was a codification of halacha, and this had to be in Lashon Kodesh, both for its language and for its purpose. The Mishneh Torah brought about correspondence with the Rambam from all over, especially the Jews in Provence, but from all over. And the Rambam writes in one of his letters, he didn't write in English, but I'll give you the English translation. He says, I have never claimed that I don't make mistakes. On the contrary. And he writes to the people who are writing to him, don't humble yourselves. You may not be my teachers, but you are my equals, and therefore all questions are valid and all criticism is valid. And even later on, when he would produce the Meir Nebuchim, and there would be strong criticism of the Meir Nebuchim, he never responded by saying Kablu Daiti. He never responded by attacking those that attacked him. He said, this is what I believe to be the MS, and that was his way forward in life. And interestingly, he had the Ibn Tibbon family in Marseille, in the south of France, translated his works, especially the works that he wrote in Arabic, namely the Perush Mishnayos and the Meir Nebuchim. They translated it. And at one stage, Shmuel Ibn Tibbon wrote to the Rambam and said that he wants to come and visit him. This was in 1199, this was 5 years before the Rambam died. And the Rambam responds, and we have the letter. He says, listen, he owes him a tremendous hakara satoiv. So he says, with respect to your wish to come here to me, didn't write in English, I cannot say how much your visit would delight me, for I truly long to communicate with you, and would anticipate our meeting with a greater joy even than you. But I have to advise you not to expose yourself to the perils of the voyage, because you wouldn't be able to speak to me, not by day, nor by night. And then he writes his famous daily timetable. What did the Rambam, who by then had been the chief rabbi of Egypt for over 30 years, who was a person who by then had produced the Perush Mishnayos, the Mishnah Torah, the Meir Nebuchim, was known to every Yid who was learning Torah in the world at the time. What was his daily timetable? So he says, I live in Fustat, and the Sultan, because he was a doctor, lives in Cairo, which is 2 tumim away from where I live. My duties to him are very heavy. I have to visit him every day, and often I cannot quit Cairo and stay most of the day there. He says, when he comes back, he is almost dying with hunger. I find my antechambers filled with people, Jews and non-Jews, important and unimportant, who await my return. I dismount from my animal, wash my hands, and I partake the only meal that I have every 24 hours. Then I attend my patients, write prescriptions and directions for their ailments. Patients go in and out, and sometimes, I assure you, until 2 hours in the night, which is 8 o'clock. I converse and prescribe from them while lying down on my back from sheer fatigue. And when night falls, I am so exhausted, I can scarcely speak. In fact, in the very beginning of the letter, when he writes, originally he says, at times I have even to lean for support against the wall, at other times I have to write lying down on account of my excessive weakness. Right, that's how much kochus it took from the Rambam. In consequence of this, no Jew can speak with me or have a private interview with me except on Shabbos. And therefore he says, you could come, but you couldn't speak to me. So the Rambam, the tragedy of the Rambam, who we would have assumed spending most of his time learning. He's spending most of his time as a physician because of the various demands that are placed upon him. And in the same way as Hillel Mechayev Es Ha'anim, so the Rambam is Mechayev anybody who works for a living. Whether a professional, whether a businessman, there's no excuse. Because read the Rambam's letter, we understand why there is no excuse not to learn Torah. Incredibly, even when the Rambam was, so to speak, at the height of his fame, when he produced the Meir Nebuchim, he was attacked. And attacked not just in the way that Haifa the Rivad wrote on the Rambam's Mishnah Torah, but attacked that his Sforim were burnt. And we cannot conceive of somebody who was held in such high regard being denigrated in such a way. But we have to be aware that things don't change much. And it's just different theatres of war, so to speak. But things very much have a continuation, what was still is. One last thing, and that is, in Cairo, he was misaken that they should not have Shtil Shmini Esrei and Chazaras HaShatz from Musaf. In other words, they should only have Chazaras HaShatz. Those people who knew the davening off by heart, remember the Siddurim weren't printed, those who knew the davening off by heart would daven with the Chazan, and those that didn't would listen to the Chazan and say Omei. Why? Because there was too much talking in Shul. Because those people who didn't know davening off by heart during Shtil Shmini Esrei, they'd stand there and talk. So he made a takana, and it wasn't until the times of the Rav Vaz, who was also the chief rabbi of Egypt in the 16th century, that he undid the takana. Right? But until then, he held on to it. The Rambam, therefore, if we want to understand the Rambam, we have to understand, besides for his tremendous godless in Torah, there was a tremendous mesiras nefesh to the Rambam when he wrote his letters. We have to understand that beyond that, there was an ability to lead a kehillah, an entire country that he was leading. We have to understand also that he was very, very human. And that when his brother died, it affected him in such a way he could not live, he couldn't cope. That's where he was. He was all human, very human. And with this all, and all the attacks that came his way, which he never responded to, that is what makes the Rambam the person he was. Of course, his Torah is the Ikka. But how that Torah was created, under what circumstances, who he was as a person, all went into the creating of the Torah and the making of the Rambam, a person who we could say about me, Moshe Vad Moshe Leikom Kamesha.